Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally, 7 days a week in more than 112 countries over the Internet around the world. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on education versus indoctrination when we come back. You know, when people call the law school, they oftentimes ask me how they can learn more about the topics that I speak on over the air. Well, keep in mind that most of these topics that you hear on the radio, I teach in detail in one of my classes here at the law school. For example, when you hear me talking about the common law, it was Alfred the Great who codified that common law back in 872 AD into 49 principles or statutes, of which 22 of those statutes have been incorporated into our federal Constitution and Bill of Rights. This common law was taken from the Mosaic law given to Moses at Mount Sinai. It's recorded in the Bible in Exodus 19, verse 16, through Exodus 24, verse 8, and it includes negligence, insurance, and taxes, such as income tax, property tax, social security taxes. These IRS tax laws are, in fact, a counterfeit of the tithing laws of the Bible, and they work a theft on everyone who participates in them. Now, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob gave us a better way of life than income tax and social security. And that's the basis of our tax and status school. We owe this income tax and social security taxes because we contract into them. Well, has it occurred to us that maybe we ought to contract out of them? Now, if you'd like to learn more about tax and status, why don't you write for our free general law CD package? It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free. You can call and order one right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website and send us an email. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Just click on the email. Send us an email request. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. Why don't you do it right now before you forget? All right, we're talking about education versus indoctrination. The last segment, we took a look at San Quentin. It was a story about a young fellow that graduated from high school and then ended up robbing his aunt of $500 back in 1886. And what happens to a young man after he graduates from school? What happens to us when we get our liberal arts education and maybe even go on to college and get a degree in college, and we come out of college and here we are out in the marketplace, out in the workplace with a big debt, student loan debt? And we find that in 1886, when Zach Montgomery wrote the book, he discovered, by looking at the census statistics from 1850 to 1880, that the more money we spend on public school, the more crime, poverty, insanity, suicide, and murder and unemployment that we have. And each one of these social ills is directly proportional, and you can directly look at the statistics of the public school system and the number of people that end up in prison, poor, or insane, and committing suicide or murder, and they run exactly in proportion. In fact, the more money you spend, in some cases, you can get a multiple effect. You can get a multiplier effect. You can spend twice as much money on education and get six times more crime. Not always. Generally speaking, it's about double. Sometimes it's three, but sometimes it goes as high as 6 to 1. That's a real multiplier effect. And so Zach Montgomery took a look and they said, what causes that? Okay, what causes it? He took a look at six states in the South, six states in the Northeast, and he said, okay, here are the six New England states practicing what he called the anti-parental school model. He took six states in the South, Virginia, North and South Carolina, Georgia, Delaware, and Maryland, and he said these people practice the parental education model, and they took a look at the statistics down there, but very little in comparison to the social problems of the North. And he said there's got to be a reason for that. And the answer to that is morality. Morality. And George Washington made an observation concerning this thing of morality. Let me read it to you. In his farewell address, George Washington, speaking to the Congress now, he said this, if I turn the page here, he said, Washington, in that same farewell address, explained that religion and morality are the foundation of national political prosperity, and then rhetorically questioned who, that is, a sincere friend to government, can look with indifference upon attempts to shake the foundations of this national fabric. Can a true friend to America really be indifferent to what the court has done in making or shaking America's foundation of religion and morality? Not in Washington's opinion. Now, I don't know that George Washington was a particularly religious man or that he was jumping up and down, running in and out of the church doors every Sunday. He may have been, he may not have, I don't know. But he came to the conclusion that morality and religion cannot be divorced from government. Now, Zach Montgomery comes to the same conclusion in Chapter 11. He makes this observation. He says, Section 1702 of our California school law provides, among other things, that it shall be the duty of all teachers to endeavor to impress upon the minds of the pupils the principles of morality. But just here the question arises, what is morality? And how is a teacher to know what it is that he or she is required to teach in order to comply with this requirement of the statute? Now, George Washington said, let us with caution indulge the supposition that morality can be maintained without religion. Washington did not believe that you could maintain morality without religion. And yet today we have the separation of church and state dogma indoctrinated into all of us, that you have to separate church and state. It's the law, number one. Number two, it won't work without doing that. Evidently, Washington didn't know that, didn't believe it. Now, we've had 200 years of experimentation. At about 1962, we jumped the tracks of sanity by banning the Bible and God from our public schools. Up until then, we hadn't gone that far. And we had gone a long ways down the wrong road, but we hadn't gone quite that far. But if morality cannot be maintained without religion, then how is it possible that we would require for the teacher in public school to inculcate the principles of morality without inculcating the principles of religion? But the principles of religion are understood by the Jews differently from what they are by the Christians, and by the Roman Catholics differently from they are by the Protestants, and by the Episcopalians differently from what they are by the Presbyterians, and by the Presbyterians differently from what they are by the Unitarians, and by those who reject the authority both of the Old and the New Testament differently from what they are by either Jews or Christians or by any other denomination, whatever. So then, let me ask again, how is it possible for the state to require the teaching of morals in the public schools without requiring, as the basis of such teaching, the inculcation of religious principles such as are necessarily antagonistic to the consciousness or the conscientious convictions of the parents of at least a portion of the children attending these schools? It is true, and we hear a great deal about the broad principles of common morality and of a common religion, but we have never yet had the good fortune to find anybody who was able to give a definition of this common morality or common religion to the perfect satisfaction of anyone, let alone everyone, except perhaps it was the self-conceited author of such a definition. So here's the conundrum. You can't have morality without religion, but you can't have religion in public school. Has it ever occurred to us that we ought to abolish the public school? I know it's a radical concept, but it's never occurred to anybody. It's the 10th plank to the Communist Manifesto. Has it ever occurred to us to stop practicing communism? I know that's a radical concept here in America, but you know, we had life in this country before communism. It seemed to work out pretty well for us. We became the wealthiest, most powerful political, economic power in the world between 1787 and 1900 without communism. We began to accept communism with the public school program back in the 1870s and 80s. Actually, we started in 1838 up in Massachusetts, but you know, commonly. By 1900, we had just about universally here in the United States accepted the 10th plank to the Communist Manifesto. By 1933, we put a fellow in office called Franklin D. Roosevelt, and he implemented all of the other 9 planks. Today, we Americans practice all 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto. My question is, has it ever occurred to us that maybe the basic social problems that we're all suffering from, that is, criminality, poverty, insanity, suicide, murder, and unemployment, could be solved if we would quit practicing communism? Because before we started practicing communism, we didn't have a criminal, poverty, insanity, suicide, murder, or unemployment problem in this country. Before we had public school, we did not have a criminal, pauper, insanity, suicide, murder, or unemployment problem. Now, most people would be reluctant to draw the conclusions that Zach Montgomery has drawn, but as he pointed out in Chapter 1, he said, hey, listen, figures don't lie. Liars figure, but figures don't lie. He cited from the official statistics of the Census Department, we since then, and in a neat book, I got to tell you the story here in this neat book, a guy by the name of David Barton carries it forward, you know, from Zach Montgomery in a book called America to Pray or Not to Pray, comes to the same conclusion. So you know what the problem is? Public school. It's not education. It's not parochial school. It's not parental education. It is the anti-parental education. It is the anti-fifth commandment education of the public school that is causing your problem. When you stop violating the fifth commandment, boys and girls, these 6 problems will evaporate. We didn't have them when we practiced the fifth commandment. Before we started practicing communism and abolishing God and the Bible from our minds and from our educational process, we didn't have these problems. The Amish don't have these problems. The parochial schools don't have these 6 problems. They're only in the public schools. So, 48 million students now are going to the public schools. About 5 or 6 million are going to other sources of education. The 5 or 6 million that are going to parochial schools and homeschools aren't having these problems. So, I throw that out for your consideration. Now, David Barton's book called America to Pray or Not to Pray. You can get a copy from Wall Builder Press, still in publication, Post Office Box 397, Aledo, Texas 76008. Now the price of it was, I think it's $12. Why don't you call them? The number is 817-441-6044. That's 817-441-6044. Remember, that's called Wall Builder Press. Guy's name is David Barton. Aledo, Texas. P.O. Box 397, Aledo. A-L-E-D-O, Texas 76008. Alright, now, in Chapter 5, here's the way Barton puts it. He says, in national policy, just as with each previous category, prior to 1962, the courts had consistently ruled that Christian principles were vital to and must be included in public policy. They stressed that Christianity was part of the common law, for example, the foundation on which all other laws rested. Now, the wise legislature framed this great body of laws for the Christian country and Christian people. This is the Christianity of the common law. In this, the Constitution of the United States has made no alteration. No free government now exists in the world today unless where Christianity is acknowledged and is the religion of the country, it is the only stable support of all human laws. Now that was cited in Updegraff versus Commonwealth in the Pennsylvania Supreme Court in 1824. That court did not have in their mind separation of church and state. Second, Christianity is part of the common law of the land. It has always been so recognized. The U.S. Constitution allows it as part of the common law. In the courts over which we preside, we daily acknowledge Christianity as the most solemn part of our administration. A witness places his hand upon the books of the New Testament, which testify of our Savior's birth, life, death, and resurrection. This is so common a matter that it is little thought of as an evidence of the part which Christianity has in the common law. Cited from the Supreme Court of South Carolina, Charleston versus S.A. Benjamin in 1846. And third, whatever strikes at the door of Christianity tends manifestly to the dissolution of civil government, because it tends to corrupt the morals of the people and to destroy good order. Cited from People versus Ruggles, New York Supreme Court, 1811. Now, there's three Supreme Courts here in the United States in the 19th century who did not understand, did not practice separation of church and state. This concept of the separation of church and state didn't come about until 1947, and it started in the state of Texas. And then it spread through the judicial administration until 1962, when we formally separated the Bible, God, and the Ten Commandments from public school. Period. Now, despite scores of cases with similar declarations, in 1962-63, the court declared exactly the opposite. The rulings since 1962-63 have encouraged indiscriminate warfare against traditional religious principles. In 1961, there were very few serious challenges against religious principles in public affairs. By the mid-1970s, there were 84 cases. Now, notice this. In 1961, there were very few serious challenges. By the 1970s, there were 84 cases. However, from 1980 to 91, the number had soared to over 3,000 legal challenges. The court's message was clear. Christian religious expressions are not welcome in public affairs and will be taken to court. And this policy, judged by the warnings and the predictions of our founding fathers, is a blueprint for the domestic disaster that is about to befall us. Notice George Washington's warning in his farewell address. He said, of all of the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports. In vain would that man claim the tribute of patriotism who would labor to subvert religion and morality. The mere politician, equally with the pious man, ought to respect and to cherish them. Where is the security for property, for reputation, for life, without the sense of religious obligation? Who, that is a sincere friend to it, government, can look with indifference upon attempts to shake the foundation of this fabric? Now, those are very powerful words from the father of our country. Do not let anyone claim to be a true patriot if he attempts to subvert religion and morality from politics. Did you hear that again? George Washington said, do not let anyone claim to be a true patriot if he attempts to subvert religion and morality from politics. Noah Webster, another founder, articulated the belief cherished by the framers of the Constitution. Here's what Noah Webster said. The moral principles and precepts contained in the Scripture ought to form the basis of all of our civil constitutions and laws. All the miseries and evils which men suffer from vice, crime, ambition, injustice, oppression, slavery, and war proceed from their despising or neglecting the precepts contained in the Scripture. Noah Webster. Now, a very wise insight. Most problems are the result of ignoring or improperly applying God's Word. Webster's warning, coupled with Washington's warning, where is the security for property, for reputation, for life, without the sense of religious obligation? They form an incredibly accurate prediction of what occurred in our nation. And the following graph indicates the loss of security for both property and life, which has occurred since the court despised or neglected the precepts found in the Scripture. And that's what Zach Montgomery pointed out. He said, "Now, wait a minute. You're going to put morality in the hands of teachers. But these teachers in the public school, some of them are atheists. And some of these people are Baptists and Catholics and Mormons. And, you know, they come from all stretch. Hell, you might even have some teachers who may be whores, sodomites. How are they going to teach morality?" Which takes us back to the parental model again. Now, you know, a whore working in Times Square in New York has morals. Then what is morality? Morality is your sense of right and wrong. Your sense of right and wrong is what your morals are. So a Baptist's morals or Baptist morality comes from his Baptist upbringing, from his Baptist parents. That's assuming he assimilates Baptist morality. If he has been sent to public school, then he has adopted the state's morality. Well, what is the state's morality? Well, it's, for instance, state morality calls for 14-year-old girls to be taught to be submissive to 14-year-old boys and have sexual relations prior to marriage. So the practice of fornication in the state moral code is perfectly acceptable. No problem. Now, I don't know what Baptists think about that, and I don't know what you think of it. And I think it sucks. That's my personal opinion. And so, years ago, I took my children out of the public school and started educating them at home. I said, I think I will be the determining factor as to the morals of my children. Now, my children are all grown up and they're adults. And they've left home. And they've married. And they have children of their own. And now that they have left home, they're free to make the choices, the moral choices for themselves. But when they were of tender age, I made their moral choices for them. I dictated to them. I said, thou shalt not commit adultery. Thou shalt not practice fornication. Now, that they're adults, they can go out and hell, my daughters can become whores in Times Square just like any other prostitute if they so desire. They're all free, white, and 21. They can go do it if they want. I didn't think it was good for them when they were 10, 12, 15 years old. I don't think it's good for them today. And if one of them came to me and said, well, Dad, I'm going to change my occupation. I think I'll become a prostitute. I think I'd tell her that you're making a mistake, sweetheart, but you know, that's your choice in life. You're an adult. You can go out and do whatever the hell you want. All right. Now, the people that I mentioned in the last program down in Texas, these Mormons down there, they have morals. They're not your morals. They're not the morals of a hooker in Times Square. They're not the morals of a Baptist or a social lady or a police chief or a county sheriff in Texas. They're something different than that. They do have different practices. They're practicing polygamy and they're practicing underage marriage. Well, underage by whose standards? Well, it was the state of Texas that set the standard for minimum age for females to marry. So it's Texas morality. It's the Texas state morality. You didn't get that from the Bible. I doubt if they got it from the Mormons or the Baptists or the Catholics or anybody else. Somebody came up with the idea that 16 is the minimum age for marriage in Texas. And so they incorporated that into the law of Texas and said that's what we want to do. Now let me bring out a wild new concept to you people here that maybe you'd never thought of before. Has it ever occurred to us to leave the Baptists alone and let them decide for themselves what Baptist morality ought to be? I know it's something different than mine. If it wasn't, I would be a Baptist, and I am not a Baptist. I'm not about to become a Baptist. But I was thinking about this, and I said, well, if I were to dictate to the Baptists my morality, and if I had the power, and if I could dictate my morality to them, I would be playing the role of God Himself. And I got to thinking about that, and I said, well, who am I to dictate to the Baptists or the Mormons or the Catholics or you or anybody else what your morality ought to be? I came to the conclusion that I'm really not competent or qualified to determine for you what your morals should be. I don't think that I'm competent or qualified to dictate to a prostitute or a hooker in Times Square what her morality ought to be. I think I know what my morality ought to be, and I subscribe to that. And you subscribe to yours. And everybody has their morality. And of course, the majority, now that we're practicing Democrats, the majority can enforce, through the police power of the state, our collective morality on the minorities. And that's what we're doing down in Texas. We, the majority, have decided that the morality of the Mormon polygamists in Texas is wrong, and we're going to stop it. All right. Now, we've done that. We sent social ladies down there, and they've taken 436 children out of their homes, and they're going to put them in foster homes, and they'll board them out. And those children will all come from broken homes. They're going to educate them in the public school. And those students that go to that public school are going to be exposed to the same anti-parental education that you and I were exposed to. Now, we could do that to the Amish also. You know, we could destroy the Amish society. After all, we're the majority. What we need to do is to go into all of the Amish homes and take all of their children away from them, complaining that their morality is something less than the state demands. Take all of their children and spread them around to other foster homes. We did that to the Indians in this country. We just went into the tribes, took their children, sent them off to white homes, educated them in the white man's customs, and we destroyed the Indian culture and the Indian morality. Now, if we can do it to the Indians, and if we are prepared to do it to the Mormons, I don't see why we can't do it to the Amish, the Dukhobors, the Mennonites, and any and every other religious minority. Furthermore, I don't even see a good reason why we shouldn't. Now, I took a look at it, and I asked myself, how did the moral practices of these polygamists in Texas affect George Gordon and Isabella, Missouri? My conclusion was it did not affect me at all. Zero. And any 16-year-old girl who's been married off, or under 16-year-old girl to some guy, when she gets of age, or even before then, when she comes to the conclusion that she's had enough of it, she can run away. She can leave there. I did. Hell, I left home when I was 13. If George Gordon can leave home when he's 13, surely a 21-year-old Mormon polygamist woman living in Texas can run away, can leave the polygamist society, church, group, sect, compound in Texas, if she so desires. But did it ever occur to us that maybe those women down there practicing polygamy don't want to leave? Has it entered anybody's mind that those people are perfectly happy and satisfied living their Mormon polygamous life? Has that entered anybody's consciousness? Has it occurred to us that the women who are being subjugated by the Amish men, and that these Amish men who are being subjugated and indoctrinated into this Amish religious ideology, maybe they like it. Did it ever occur to you that maybe they're perfectly happy and satisfied living that lifestyle? I always figured if an Amish man wanted to leave the Amish community and he couldn't leave, they wouldn't let him, I could then see the state coming in to aid that man in making a free choice to leave. I can see that. But I can't see the state coming in here and dictating to the Amish what their morals ought to be or how they ought to live their lives, and that maybe they should start using zippers and buttons, you know, on their clothes, you know, instead of, I guess they use buttons. I guess they don't use zippers. But, you know, I look at those Amish people, the way they dress, and I see them over here in the Walmart store every once in a while. They call it plain dressing. And I look at that, and then I look at my neat Levi's with the zipper in the front or my bib overalls, and I say, my God, I am so thankful that I'm not Amish and I don't have to dress like that. But has it occurred to any of the rest of us that maybe those people like to dress like that? I mean, we have students in our public schools that dress like total slobs. And that seems to be all right. Nobody's complaining about the way our young people today turn their baseball caps around backwards, dress like absolute slobs, act like jerks in public places, and that seems to be all right. But if an Amish guy dresses funny, we all look at that and say, my God, those people need to be liberated. I just thought I'd throw out for your consideration, did it ever occur to you that maybe they don't want to be liberated? Maybe they're happy where they're at. Maybe we could just leave it up to them to decide for themselves for a change, instead of us deciding for them what their standards of dress and what their moral code ought to be. Maybe we could just butt out, leave them alone, and let them decide for themselves. They'll probably all make the wrong decision and stay there. Probably. But what the hell difference does that make to you and me? I don't want to practice polygamy. But I'm not really sure that I'm competent or qualified to determine for somebody else that he ought not to. And I gotta ask, what business is it of ours, and how does it damage our lives, our liberties, or our property when that Mormon guy over there has three wives? Well, mull it over a little bit. Let's assume that he has three wives and he puts them on welfare. Now I can see you and me taking action. I don't think that you and I ought to support a bunch of women over here for this Mormon guy over here and at public expense. Now, let's go to New York's Harlem, where we've got all these black women over here on welfare. You know, hundreds and thousands of them. And they're all out here having sexual relations with all kinds of different men. They're not married to anybody. They're having sex, and they're reproducing, and they're producing babies at public expense. That seems to be all right. I don't hear anybody complaining about black women in Harlem having babies by 15 different men, all being supported on the public welfare. Seems to be okay. That's the kind of morality that we're looking for. And where did they learn that? I think they learned that in public school, didn't they? In sex education class, and told all them 14-year-old girls that you ought to be warm and open and have sex with Bobby. He's a good kid. Practice fornication, that's okay. But my God, let some guy down here in Texas put three women that are married and have children being raised in what they think is moral, you know, from their point of view. Why, we got to send social lady in there, disrupt that operation, take those children away from those women, put those children into foster homes, and change that to that kind of morality in a heartbeat. Write me a letter, would you, and explain to me the difference between Harlem morality and welfare, and polygamous morality and welfare, would you? Diagram it out. Hey, I got to give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard in more than 112 countries daily, worldwide, over the Internet and radio. For more information about the law school and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. And the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, then please go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives, and that can be accessed through the website as well. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that those authors or publications that we endorse are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour may be political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine, they're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, remember our website, georgegordon.org. Or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, Zach Montgomery brought up the subject of morality. And David Barton also brought it up and points out that what's coming out of the public school is, in fact, morality. It is state-sponsored, state-produced, and state morality. Social lady has a moral standard. The sheriff has a moral standard. You and I both have moral standards. Now, our moral standards are all different, and we get them from different places. One guy gets his moral concepts and beliefs from Catholicism, another guy from Baptistism, and another guy is an atheist, but he has morals. Atheists have morals. They have beliefs as to what's right and wrong. Sodomites, whores, deviants of all stripes, murderers, all have a moral code. All of them subscribe to some moral standard. Every one of us, no matter who we are or where we live, we have a sense of right and wrong, good and bad. All right, now who decides what is moral? Well, for the Muslim, it's Allah. For the Buddhist, it's Buddha. For the Christian, it's Christ. Well, at least that's what we all claim. And I'm sitting here asking the question, well, who am I to tell that Buddhist over there that he's got his head up the wrong end, or that Muslim over there that maybe his morals, you know, don't meet our standards? Did it ever occur to us that if we just butt out and leave those Muslims alone and let those people decide for themselves their own morality? I know it's kind of a wild new idea. It's a libertarian concept. It's a libertarian concept. Butt out, leave them alone, let them decide for themselves. Now, there are times when we have to interfere. When somebody is interfering with somebody else's life, their liberty, or their property. You know, when some guy says, well, I'm practicing my morals and I need to sacrifice a virgin into the volcano. Well, you know, the virgin also has rights to life, liberty, and property, and maybe she doesn't want to be sacrificed. And maybe the rest of us ought to intervene on behalf of the virgin to protect her life, liberty, and property. And of course, the state of Texas is doing just that. They're sitting down there saying, well, we need to intervene in the lives, the liberties, and the properties of these Mormons because they don't meet the same moral standards that we do. And I'm sitting there saying, well, how did the practice of those Mormons down there interfere with the lives, the liberties, or the properties of any other Texans? Because if it did, maybe the state did need to interfere. But they didn't interfere with any of my rights, liberties, or properties, and so I'm sitting here saying I'd just soon leave them alone. Now, there's a reason why the state of Texas needs to interfere, and that's because of employment. See, you've got tens of thousands of social ladies that went to college and became educated in the same anti-parental schools that you and I were educated in, and they have to have employment. And so they went to work for the state, enforcing the state's morals. And so the state legislature had to come up with a moral code. So the social lady would have a moral code to enforce upon all the people of Texas. And so that's what the social ladies are doing. See, in order to keep all of these social ladies off the streets and out of the pool halls, we had to give them employment. That's what we're doing for all of the paleontologists and geologists and anthropologists and all the people that have been educated now in their liberal arts education, and they don't want to work. They don't want to produce. They don't want to sweat. They want to pinch the girls on the butt, walking up and down the halls of the office in air-conditioned offices, drinking water at the water cooler, and doing as little as possible of any useful, productive, meaningful work. And as I pointed out, I said, you know, there's a limit to, you know, if 10,000 social ladies are good for Texas, wouldn't 20,000 be twice as good? If 20,000 social workers in Texas is twice as good as 10,000, can you imagine what 40,000 would be like? Let's put it another way. Why don't we graduate every student in the state of Texas to be a social worker? Don't you think we could abolish all immorality in Texas? Don't you think we could abolish all child abuse in Texas? I mean, just think of it. Every college graduate in Texas is now a social worker. Licensed, bonded, and insured. Well, where are they going to get work? Well, they're going to have to get it from the state of Texas. Well, if that's the case, then where is the state of Texas going to get the money? Well, there aren't any doctors, there aren't any dentists, there aren't any other professionals. Everybody in the state is a social worker. It doesn't take a real bright fella to figure out that that'll never work. Because we got to have some doctors and dentists. Hell, it occurs to me that we might even need a couple of plumbers and three or four carpenters. Because without plumbers and carpenters and electricians and other blue-collar workers, where in the hell are all these social ladies going to live? Okay, now it doesn't take too much imagination to figure out that in the final analysis, as Zach Montgomery pointed out in his story concerning the young man that went to high school, his daddy was laying cobblestones on Battery Street in San Francisco. Did it ever occur to you that we need people to lay cobblestones? I mean, you know, if you're going to have a cobblestone street, doesn't somebody have to get off his dead ass and get out there and lay those cobblestones for you and I to walk on, drive on, and use? Now, in times past, before we got this education mania, a cobblestone layer would have trained his sons to be cobblestone layers. A farmer would train his children to be farmers. You know, the Amish people, do you know what they train their children to do? Amish people are all farmers. And they train all of their children to fit into their lifestyle and in their occupation, their vocation in life as farmers. Every Amish boy is trained to be a farmer, and every Amish girl is trained to be a farm a farmer's wife. And by God, those people have morality. And they don't steal, they're not cheating, they're not in prison, they don't suffer from unemployment, they're not insane, they're not in our insane asylums, and they're not drawn welfare. There isn't any Amish guy in America, and I doubt if there's an Amish guy in the world that is living in poverty. They don't have poverty. They don't allow it. They're all working. What's wrong with Amish morality? Looks like it's pretty good morality to me. Their sense of right and wrong in the Amish community looks like it's pretty damn good. Even though George Gordon does not want to be an Amish man. I'm not Amish. I don't want to join their church. I don't want to join their Amish religion. I just don't want to oppress and persecute them. I just don't want to butt into the Amish people's business and try to dictate to them my morality. I think my morality is superior to the Amish morality. And maybe someday those Amish people will wake up to the wonderful morality of George Gordon, and they will all repent in sackcloth and ashes and change their wicked ways. But meanwhile, back on the farm, should I go into the Amish community and enforce George Gordon's morality upon them? And if the answer to that is no, which is my conclusion, then I got to ask the question, well, should I go to Texas and enforce my morality upon those Mormon polygamists? And my conclusion to that is no. Well, then should I enforce my morality upon all you Catholics, who I absolutely despise and loathe? And my conclusion is no. I don't think I should impose my morality upon you Catholics. And historically, boys and girls, when we left the Catholics alone and they employed their own morality, they came out pretty good. Not as good as you and I, to be sure. But they did come out pretty good. We found that the Catholics could solve their criminal problem. They weren't impoverished. They weren't insane, didn't commit suicide, murder, and they weren't unemployed. If you just leave the Catholics alone, they'll muddle through. They won't do it as fast. They won't do it as well. They're not as good as we are, but they can do it. And if you take a look at the Mormons and everybody else around us, it isn't until Social Lady butts in. It isn't until the state butts in. It isn't until all of us get together using the police power that we butt into everybody else's business and create this public school anti-parental school model and enforce this morality upon everybody that we start coming up with all the criminality and the poverty and the insanity and the suicide and the murder and the unemployment. Now, if that's what you want, if you want more criminals, more paupers, more insane, more suicides, more murder, and more unemployment, you cannot possibly come up with a better model than you've already got. I mean, this thing is working perfectly. It is absolutely perfect. You're turning out criminals. You're educating them right there in the public schools. You're turning out whores just as fast as you can. If you're trying to turn out virgins out of the public school system, you're a total failure. More than 90% of females coming out of our high schools they've already been used meat, you know, by the time they're 18. I mean, if you're looking for virgins out of the public school system, that's a total failure. If you're looking for sluts, harlots, and whores, you are 100% successful. Hell, 90% of them are. There's a few failures, to be sure. I think it's running around 6% of the females coming out of our public high schools now are virgins. It is true that we are failing in 6% of our females to turn them into whores. But we're 94% successful. Now, they're telling us now that we've got 10% of our male population are now homosexuals. All right, we're not where we want to be. I'm sure that we want 100% homosexuality in the United States of America. Indeed, I suppose that we want 100% homosexuality in the world. Well, from the point of view of the homosexuals, we do. I mean, all homosexuals have moral standards. Albeit they may be different from you Baptists, but they've got moral standards. They've got a sense of right and wrong. And from their point of view, they'd like to turn everybody in the world. They would like to liberate everybody in the world. They would like to introduce everybody in the world into the same sexual practices that they are practicing. They want to liberate you. And I guess that means that all of us, in the ultimate end, to the sodomites' moral standards, will all become sodomites. Now, let's suppose that that's the case and we all become sodomites. What's the ultimate end of that? Well, isn't it the extinction of the human race? I mean, boys and girls, sexual relations between male and male does not, the last time I checked, produce any offspring. Now, those Mormon polygamists down there are producing a lot of offspring. If you leave those Mormon polygamists alone, and just let them continue on, and if we carried that to its ultimate extreme, and we convert everybody in the world into a Mormon polygamist, what will the ultimate end be? Well, the entire world will be made up of polygamists. How's that going to work? Well, the last time I checked, the birth rate between male and female is about 50-50. As I understand, it favors males by a tad. No, it favors females by a tad. That's what it is. About 51.8% of live births are females, but, you know, in round numbers, you know, it comes out about 50-50. So how much polygamy are you going to have in the world? Damn little. Not very much. How much polygamy do you have in the world right now today? Not much. Not much. It is true that there are a few more females in the world than there are males, and for that reason you need polygamy so that all those males can have a male, or excuse me, all those females can have a male partner for sexual reproduction. It is true. And in the Bible there are 24 cases of polygamy. I mentioned a couple of famous ones to you here in a couple programs back. I said, Jacob, who is the founder of the dynasty of the Israelites, had four wives. He was a practicing polygamist. God didn't have any problems with Jacob's four wives. None at all. He never had a bad word for Jacob's four wives. He never once said, Jacob, Jacob, you dirty, low-down, no-good, immoral rascal. You know, you have four wives over there. He never said that once. In fact, he told David, he said, you know, I gave you Saul's wives, and you go out here and you commit adultery with this Bathsheba woman. He upbraided David not for having six wives. He upbraided David for committing adultery and killing a man and stealing his wife. Now, he didn't care much for that, but he didn't have any harsh words for David over polygamy. The ultimate end would be that the human race would continue on, albeit with more than one wife per husband. But you wouldn't have very many like that because look, there aren't that many women to go around. Now if the birth rate were, you know, 2, 3, 4 women for every man, well then, you know, polygamy would be more necessary. There's a little bit of polygamy outlined in the Bible. It's a rare event, doesn't occur very often, doesn't affect you and I, doesn't affect our moral standards at all, and I don't think it affects the moral standards of the people involved. In fact, through this law school, I probably have 6 polygamists a year come through here. That'd be my guess. And of all of the polygamists that have come through this law school in 25 years, I haven't seen any criminals, paupers, insane, suicides, murderers, or unemployed. I have never run across an unemployed polygamist. Well, not in this law school. So it looks like to me the polygamists seem to be able to take care of their employment problems. Just like the Amish. They don't cause me any grief. They don't cause me any problems. They're not stealing my property. They're not raising hell with me. And so I came to the conclusion, you know, I could probably just leave those guys alone. It wouldn't hurt me a bit. And that's a new concept. And it's a new concept for Americans. We Americans have our nose in everybody's business around the world. And if you people in Iraq think that we Americans have our nose in your business, hell, we can't keep our nose in our own business in our own country. We've got our nose in every neighbor's business around the country, in every state in the Union. We're butting into the business of the Amish. We're butting into the business of the Baptists, butting into the business of everybody in the country. We're just buttinskis. Americans are just plain big nose buttinskis. And that's why I thought I'd bring this to your attention and point out to you that your social evils that you get from butting your nose into everybody else's business, it causes a tremendous amount of crime, a tremendous amount of poverty, a moderate amount of insanity, quite a bit of suicide, a lot of murder, and quite a bit of unemployment with a lot more to come. And that's basically from our public school system of butting into and trying to tell everybody else how to live their lives. So I thought I'd come out and say, look, why don't we rethink this? Why don't we come to a new conclusion? Now, for those of you out there says, well, I think you're right, Gordon, and I'd like to entertain that idea. Why don't you write for our free general law CD package? Let me tell you a little bit more about this whole concept. And then let's take a look at it more pragmatically. What do you do to jerk your kid out of the public school without having social aid come out and take your kid away? And that comes from what we call a legal education. It's the education that God designed. He said, I think all of you people need to have a legal education so that you can deal with social aid. And the EPA and the IRS and all the tax people and all these government bureaucrats that are running around with their nose in your business trying to eat out your substance. And believe it or not, God has a very logical, very sensible plan for doing that. The Bible lays out a legal education in which you can educate your children at home with relative security and peace of mind. There's a provision made in every state in this union for you to do just that. Every state in the union. How do you deal with social aid? There's a process laid out in the Bible. It's in Exodus 23, verses 20 through 24. Just jot that down. There's a statute. It says, here's the way we deal with social aid, the EPA, the tax man, zoning and planning, building inspectors. A logical, very practical, systematic modality for doing it. I think that a legal education is really the foundation or basis for a liberal arts education. And maybe a liberal arts education is good for you. Maybe you should learn how to read and write. And maybe you should learn geography. You know, I'm not opposed to somebody being able to pick up a map and point out Australia or New Zealand or find Moldova on the map, for instance. But is it really necessary? I mean, the other day we found that Moldova is situated next to Romania, a landlocked country of about 13,000 square miles. I couldn't find it. I never heard of it. And I thought I was educated. So we looked it up on Google, and we found out. I said, oh my God, there's a country called Moldova. Moldova or Moldavia. Okay, well now I'm educated. But before I was educated, you know, I lived for 70 years. Never heard of the place. Let me remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 100 countries around the world daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals by prearrangement. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, our time's up. I got to leave it right there. So we'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.